Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, it's a huge development impacting college athletes' name, image, and likeness, and we'll explore the Underground Railroad and its rich history in New Jersey. But we begin with Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood and the ongoing challenge around homeless encampments. In 2019, four large encampments in Kensington were disassembled. But since then, new gatherings have grown, and residents say they and their children again have to endure the presence of illegal drug use, paraphernalia left on sidewalks and in parks, and human waste. They are asking the city for relief, but supporters of the unsheltered say those living on the streets need to be able to stay until housing is made available to them, and there has been at least one recent court challenge. So, can Philadelphia come up with a solution preserving the rights of residents and the unsheltered? Councilwoman Maria Quinones-Sanchez represents North Philadelphia's 7th District, and she joins us now. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup, Maria.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about our challenges in Kensington.
So why don't we begin with a characterization, if you will, of the situation in the neighborhood as it looks right now, mid-July. Describe the streets around the encampment and how residents and those who are homeless are faring.
Yeah, it's very important for folks to recognize that the residents of Kensington have been incredibly resilient. Many essential workers who did not have the privilege of working home during COVID, many who experience housing instability themselves as it's a working poor community, and who have been incredibly supportive. This is year four of Kensington and our failed encampment policy for the city of Philadelphia. They have themselves had families and family members in addiction. They themselves have lost folks in addiction. And they would be the first ones to tell you that housing should be provided to all of those who need housing. But we have two different populations in Kensington. We have folks who are homeless. We have a $110 million homeless budget in the city of Philadelphia. And according to the city, 5,000 homeless. That's $22,000 per person. We should be doing better. As it relates to the folks in addiction, we all know this is a mental health crisis that the world is experiencing. We know, and there's nothing humane about folks in addiction living in tents among their own human feces. There is nothing humane about that. And so what we have here is a convergence of a storm of bad policy, COVID, poverty, and then institutional racism about how the city deals with a poor community. We've seen encampments in Logan Square, Rittenhouse Square, be dismantled permanently, right? And folks moved into housing, those who need to be moved into housing. We've not seen that in Kensington, and this is year four.
So why not? I mean, you said institutional racism, if I heard you correctly. Tell us more about this and why it seems as if this is a situation that cannot be resolved in Kensington.
So
a
it's
tough
a
situation.
It's a political will situation. When we saw the encampments and open spaces downtown along the parkway, the residents of Logan Square organized, came to the city, and the city reacted. And you saw an all-hands-on-deck approach, and that encampment dismantled within 30 days. In Kensington, this is year four. This is about a containment strategy that they started. And for residents who were very supportive of us locating Prevention Point there for needle exchange, never expecting a needle exchange program that was about a half a million needles to 5 million needles, never consulted. The residents supported the creation of respite centers because we knew we had a homeless situation and a problem. We set up two respite centers with the support of the community, and we promised that we were going to protect their quality of life, and the city has failed to do that.
Who do you hold responsible?
I hold the mayor. The mayor has not been there. There's no one who can go to Kensington and stand along the block captains, one who was injured last week. He was assaulted for reclaiming his spaces. The city tells us, you have to help us reclaim these spaces. And then you have a block captain that is assaulted. We have some of our community partners that live at McPherson Square who day in and day out are forced to come out of their houses alarmed, right, just to get into their cars. So the mayor has to say, Fentanyl has changed the game. Our treatment providers, 50% of our slots go unused every day. Fentanyl has changed the game. How do we evolve? How do we stop the checking off the barriers and access to treatment, from the no smoking policy to the cooling off conditions to people not wanting to go into the treatment that we're currently providing?
So you're saying there is red tape that is preventing getting folks who are unsheltered off the street and into treatment?
Absolutely. All of us who have to navigate this space know that the treatment being provided for the reality of the fentanyl drug is not effective. And so we really need to have medical experts tell us. But what we should not be okay with is saying that harm reduction means we're going to let people live on the streets under these conditions with the open prostitution and the open air injection market that we see in Kensington. That should not be acceptable to anyone.
The city was planning to do a sweep of the encampments in mid-June. A lawsuit was filed. It was since dropped, but is likely to be filed again. Let's talk about that lawsuit briefly by Villanova, filed in part by Villanova law professor Stephanie Sena, I believe. Sena? I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, so I apologize.
It doesn't matter. She doesn't live in the city.
Okay.
And should not be part of this conversation. She doesn't live in Kensington, did not show up to Kensington when she asked her advocates to come in. The lawsuit was very clear. And the judge has been very clear. The city is responsible for maintaining the quality of life. The encampment and private policy and private property should not be allowed. These are people who are in harm's way and then creating harmful situation for young people who have to walk to and from school. We saw that throughout the school year. We see that now as we try to create safe spaces for young people, whether it's Harrogate Park or McPherson, where we caged the playground. And we are the city is coordinating efforts to activate the space. So it's like send the children to save the park. Mm.
What is the latest from the city about a planned sweep? Is there a date?
Well, they on Friday, they reposted those signs. And again, this is about public right-of-ways, public spaces. So Lehigh Avenue 18 and 1900 East Lehigh Avenue is targeted as 3200 Kensington. They've posted it for August 18th. But we, again, they have used up the clock of year four of Kensington. We knew this was a problem all winter. But, you know, in the cold weather, people are not seeing it. We know that in the summer, we get hundreds of people who come, who are in addiction, who come to live on the streets of Kensington. And we asked them, we pleaded with them in May. We held a public hearing, Councilmember Scuola and I, who have been confronting this head on. We held a hearing and we begged the city. And at that point, I asked them for, what are the investments in Kensington? What is it that we're doing? And this is not a money issue. $138 million get wasted in Kensington with this failed policy.
So let's talk about, again, some of the lawsuit's requests. The city, the clearing the encampment, or the encampment's plural, would violate a homeless person's Fourth Amendment right to live without unreasonable searches and seizures, and also that the city doesn't have enough shelter for those without. If I'm hearing you correctly, the primary issue here is dependency, addiction to drugs. Not necessarily folks who find themselves without shelter because they've lost a job and they've moved onto the streets. Because the next question there is there enough housing stock in the city to house those who can immediately move into a home?
We have an affordable housing crisis. I've spent most of my legislative work in this space, so I know that we have our challenges. But we also have a management issue. Again, the homeless budget is $110 million. They say we have 5,000 homeless. That's $22,000 per person. Yeah. What we're lacking is the ability to have that system. I think David Fair called it the homeless industrial complex. We have not evolved, right? We have not evolved with the housing first strategy. We have not evolved with the fentanyl crisis. Folks are in crisis. They have no control over their body, no control of what they're doing. They cannot entrap an entire community while we try to figure it out.
Obviously, there's a lot of frustration here. What is the next step?
There's going to be a lot of violence. As I said, we had a block captain who listened to the city and said, reclaim your spaces, recently assaulted by members of the encampment community.
There was a published report recently about some attacks on homeless people allegedly perpetrated by teens and children, even younger. How do we begin to approach this issue?
This is the trauma we're causing on the young people of Kensington. We have taken and have allowed their open spaces to be infiltrated and contained through this failed policy, and they're reacting. And their reaction is violence. And we're going to see more of that. And it's going to be on the hands of the city who has failed to act.
So I know you say don't criminalize these young people, but how do we address the violence at the same time?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things. We need the DA's office and the courts to work with us at creating some sort of drug court that really forces people into some treatment, but the treatment has to be adequate. We have to make sure that people are getting the treatment that they want, right, and we're nimble enough, right, and that our providers understand the physical needs and the mental challenges that fentanyl has caused. I believe we're stuck in a system that checks off the boxes, does not connect the dots, not nimble enough to respond to what we all know is a national crisis. We're the epicenter because we have failed to evolve with the change.
A couple of questions from our listeners. Luann asks, whatever happened to vagrancy laws that ban people from loitering in public? Why are encampments allowed at all?
Because the city wants as they define harm reduction is let's let people do what they want. And what we don't understand is these people are not in the right state of mind to make decisions, and we're allowing them to entrap the community. So we have all the laws in the book. Councilman Squilla and I have been always willing to look like we don't want to criminalize this, right? But we need a carrot and a stick, and we have neither, right? What we have is a situation where we have 754 people living on the streets of Kensington, traumatizing an entire community, right, in the name of harm reduction and civil rights.
How should we observe and view those people? Because they are human beings in crisis.
They need treatment, and our treatment services need to adequately respond to them. You know, this no smoking ban, you know, who gets into treatment? There's no transparency, no dashboard that says this is what works, this isn't what works. System has to be nimble enough to meet people where they are. This is a lifetime of recovery for people, right? So getting them into treatment is just the first step in what is going to be a lifetime recovery. The residents of Kensington know that well. They have family members that they are also working with.
Quick question for Mike. Even if beds were available, is it true that a lot of these folks feel more threatened in that congregate living space than on the street?
Absolutely. The homeless are, again, the industrial complex has not evolved. We want to treat people with dignity. Beacon House, which is at Episcopal Hospital that we just started, is an example. And it took us 3 years to convince the administration to do it. People need to be in dignified spaces. You know, the issue of having washer machines and just showers. Absolutely. Our system has not evolved with our times. And that's why people not coming in is their way of saying what we're doing is not effective.
Well, we certainly hope that there is some relief for the neighborhood of Kensington for all groups in the near future. A lot of conversation in a short amount of time. Philadelphia City Councilwoman Maria Quinones-Sanchez, thank you so much as always for joining us.
Thank you for keeping this on the forefront. This is a citywide problem.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Up next on the regional roundup, we'll hear from Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Mike Jensen about recent legislation that allows college athletes to capitalize on their name, image, and likeness through opportunities like paid sponsorships, etc. And also Temple University women's basketball forward Mia Davis. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. NIL, three letters that represent a day of reckoning for college athletics. They stand for name, image, and likeness. The NCAA is now allowing college athletes in all sports to make money from endorsement opportunities, which use their name, image, and likeness to promote a product, public appearance, or business venture. The athletes who benefit most will likely include the stars, of course, and also any who command a significant social media presence. Still, as all this begins to shake out, there are a lot of gray areas. Rules regulating NIL can vary from state to state, and many states do not have legislation in place. So how do college athletes and their families navigate this new and potentially lucrative landscape? Are there pitfalls to watch out for? And if mistakes are made, what are the potential penalties? We'll hear from Mia Davis, a standout athlete on Temple University's women's basketball team, in just a bit. But first, Mike Jensen joins us to help navigate. Mike is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Murray.
So college sports, Mike, as we know, is a billion-dollar industry, and many see this as an issue of fundamental fairness for the athletes. Tell us more.
Well, name, image, likeness is separate from, obviously, scholarships, cost to the schools. Basically, athletes were prohibited from using their own name. And I can give you a quick example because I wrote about it last year. Quentin Rose was a basketball star at Temple on the men's team. He had a pair of his own Jordans he wanted to sell. He was told he could not use his Instagram page because that would be benefiting from his name as a Temple basketball player. So in other words, it was almost completely backwards. If you had a name, you couldn't use it, which was, you know, borderline insane by almost anyone's definition. So this is flipping that. If you have a name, you can use it. And it's kind of an artful way for the NCAA to support something that does not involve colleges paying players, right? Because there are many, many issues with that. Who gets paid what? There are Title IX issues. Do starters get paid the same as backups? Do non-revenue sports get paid the same as revenue sports? Many, many issues. This kind of sidetracks that to the benefit of all these NCAA schools, most of whom, by the way, aren't making money. That billion-dollar industry exists in five or six leagues. Everyone else loses money.
But the athletes, even at the smaller schools, can stand to make a nice little bit of cash on the side. How might one of these transactions work? Give us an example.
Well, I went on Cameo this morning. And if people are familiar with a video service where you can buy a little video for a special occasion, for a birthday, from a celebrity, quasi-celebrity. So I went and checked what people were charging. And just for instance, let's use Villanova basketball. I quickly saw that you can get a message from Ryan Arcidiacono, who was a 2016 Villanova basketball star, $70. Mm-hmm. Chris Jenkins, who hit the winning shot off that pass from Arcidiacono, $75. Phil Booth, who scored 20 points in that game, is plays professionally, $30. But now I went further down, and Colin Gillespie, still on the Villanova team, you can get that message from him, $60. So, and there were 8 reviews saying, great, great job, great job, great job. So let's say that's how many he has done. Everyone put a review. You know, he's about $500 richer than before this came across.
Where does fair market value play into all this?
A huge factor, because the NCAA naturally has to worry about boosters just taking advantage of this, saying, Colin Gillespie, that video is worth $7,000. So that's why it's kind of interesting to see what the others are being paid. So, you know, they have to be careful that is part of both the NCAA legislation and in generally in these state by state laws that fair market value plays into it. So that and another factor is it's written in that there can be no guarantees going into recruits that, hey, you're a guarantee you will get this amount of money from name, image, likeness. So what these schools do instead is already are sort of promoting what their own efforts are in this department.
What are the limits, Mike, around NIL when it comes to student athletes and the endorsement of so-called vice products like gambling or tobacco or even adult entertainment?
They're prohibited. So you can't even promote. If my understanding is a local restaurant that has a liquor license, you can't promote them in Pennsylvania. That's part of the Pennsylvania law. And the others you mentioned, gambling, no. Adult entertainment, no. Pharmaceuticals, no. I believe tobacco, no. So sort of, the list of areas where you might find it questionable, they're out of bounds right off the bat.
And again, there isn't a ton of guidance on NIL, but, athletes are moving forward quickly. Again, if you could just tell us about the concerns about their well-being as they attempt to win deals and in situations that they might be taken advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the schools are kind of also trying to be a little bit proactive. The schools that have some resources. So they're not just worried about the compliance end, but also the marketing end. You are allowed to have a marketing representative, and that will happen, realizing in most cases, the dollars just aren't going to be that big to make it worthwhile on either end of that deal. So concerns, I mean, I had a conversation with a Power Five, meaning one of the bigger league assistant basketball coaches, about concern about if somebody's making more money than somebody else, and what's that going to be like in the locker room?
Yeah.
My response to that is, well, the coach is already making a lot of money. No one has that concerned about professional leagues. That's established. So I think I think that's a misnomer, and this can get passed. Now, that said, I did see that Miami's quarterback already said that they're going to pull their money there, and he's the highest profile player on the team, saying that he I think he was driving this, wanted everyone to benefit kind of equally, which is interesting, especially when as many players as there are on a football team.
Where do donors come into play? Someone who might want to pay an athlete, say, X number of dollars to go to a certain school, is this legit?
Well, fair market value comes into play, and let's go back to Villanova. Archie Diacono, right after the 2016 championship game, was able to sign an endorsement deal with Landover dealership in Wayne. And he was, out of eligibility. It was all legal. Chris Jenkins, who had a year of eligibility left, could not do that. Mm-hmm. And now there is, I don't read anything that's stopping the dealership or Colin Gillespie from having that same kind of arrangement while somebody's still an undergraduate.
To be clear, Mike, name, image, and likeness is not pay to play, which also remains prohibited. Give us an example here.
Well, yeah, it's all outside. It's all endorsements. And interestingly, and here's where the NCAA is taking care of itself and its schools. You can't make a deal that overrides an existing deal that the school already has. In other words, all these deals already have Nike contracts and, Adidas, Under Armour. They already have apparel contracts,
yeah,
both for uniforms and sneakers. Their coaches get paid from them. That's been going on for over three decades. A player can't suddenly make his own deal with a rival shoe company.
Well, and somebody can't pay that player, say, $100 per touchdown, right? Is that an example of pay to play?
Sure. No, and it's an example of what would not be fair market value for it. You're not paying for you're paying for performance, and that is not allowed in this name, likeness, image legislation going through.
Okay, let's get some more on guidance. I think about two dozen states have approved legislation regulating name, image, and likeness. And as you mentioned earlier, Pennsylvania is one of them. Where do New Jersey and Delaware stand?
I believe New Jersey has done the same thing. and looking at it, I believe New Jersey has completed and is roughly at the same stage as Pennsylvania. Okay. Delaware, I don't see that they have moved through on legislation. I don't think anything's hit the governor's desk there. And there's also federal pushes to just make it all uniform because, you know, right now it's kind of it's not just state by state. It's also league by league, which in some sense makes sense because, you know, the Southeastern Conference prints money and, you know, and again, 70% of the leagues don't make any money. So they have in where it comes into play here, too. They have the resources where they can show they can have apps that you know will both have compliance apps where athletes are requested. I don't know if they can be required, but they're going to be listened to register what they're doing. But then also have there's an app that Villanova has that you're going to be able to find all your photos that have ever been taken by Villanova and put them into your own personal Instagram.
Boy,
a lot of schools are doing that kind of thing.
There's just a lot shaking out here. So to kind of get our arms around this, in a state like Delaware, which does not have legislation in place yet, is it kind of like the Wild West? And should students really go to their colleges first to try to navigate?
Sure. I mean, at this point, I don't think it is something that they can do there. But everyone else is coming. You know, it seems like a new state adds legislation every week, it seems like.
Okay. Well, let's bring Temple University women's basketball forward, Mia Davis, into the conversation. She is Temple's all-time leader in made free throws and is a recipient of the Philadelphia Big Five Award. Hi, Mia.
Hello. How are you?
Well, I'm well, thank you. So if I'm understanding correctly, this will be your final year of play coming up, and you are able to participate in NIL. What are your thoughts about all this?
I'm actually very excited. I thought the rule would, like, get released or come out later, but being as though it came out my last year, I'm actually pretty excited to get started working with other, like, companies and sponsorships.
So how are you approaching this? Are you going to seek an agent or a marketing agency to for information about navigating, or are you working with Temple?
I'm definitely trying to, like, find, like, a marketing agent. We're still, like, receiving information about it. I know compliance came and talked to us about it, like, rules about it, things we can and can do. And they suggested us to get, like, an agent or somebody that's legal in Philadelphia just to, like, look over our stuff, our contract, so, like, we're not getting scammed or outworked by somebody.
Is social media going to be the primary vehicle for you, Mia, as you seek endorsement opportunities?
Yes. I think I have, like, a big social media platform, so my social media platform will help me out a lot.
And how are you going to develop your brand? What are you planning?
Just getting myself out there more, reaching out to companies. I know if I want to use my, like, Temple brand, we have to, like, get permission. Mm-hmm. Like, if I want to get promoted in my uniform or something, or somebody's posting me in my uniform, there's a lot of rules that come with it. So I'm just trying to get permission and do a lot of stuff first before I start, like, accepting contracts and stuff.
So what's been the reaction of your fellow teammates?
Everyone's excited about it because it's another way to get income, knowing that we're college athletes and everybody's been talking about this for so long. So everyone's excited to start.
One reporter we'd spoken to, and Mike had actually mentioned this earlier, said that some were concerned about the potential impact on the locker room. You know, if some athletes are more successful at this than others, become social media stars, say, raking in a lot of money, that perhaps it might change the dynamic among teammates. Do you see this happening, Mia?
Actually, I don't see that happening. I was actually thinking about this because some people have like bigger social media platforms or even like, I guess, more of the stars on the team or whatever, but I don't see it impacting the team. I look at it as though if I'm bringing in a lot of stuff, maybe I can help my teammates get like sponsorships with people too.
And with apologies, I have kind of a mom question for you. Are you at all concerned about the time this might take, you know, away from academics, you know, building a brand, pursuing endorsement opportunities? You know, you are on the Temple University women's basketball team and you've got your studies. So how does this all work for you, Mia?
I actually think this wouldn't, like, interfere, like, academics. I feel as though athletes have a great time management, so we'll be able to, like, juggle all everything that's coming our way.
Well, I'm sure you will. So let me get Mike back into the conversation here. Question from Thomas. Thomas asks, won't some smaller colleges simply drop sports to avoid a slippery slope of competing for athletes?
I think it's the opposite. I think it helps them. I don't see that this plan costs a university any money whatsoever. So, you know, even if you're, you know, Cabrini, if your athlete makes, you know, a small little deal with, you know, I wrote in a column of, you know, I stopped at the local water ice place close to some of the campuses out there. And the guy was like, sure, I'll give him a deal, you know, basically free water ice to promote me on Instagram, that sort of thing. I think for some reason everyone has this problem with, you know, if we're on that slippery slope, then coaches getting paid six-figure contracts for endorsements from shoe contracts are way up the slippery slope than small colleges. They're not losing any money from this, and the smart ones will realize they can be helped by this. And I agree with Mia, by the way, on the locker room issue in terms of, like, she's helped her teammates for the last few years a lot. So if she got something out of it, I'm kind of thinking they'd be happy for that.
All right. Well, so we've only got about 30 seconds left, but Mia, what next for you? How do you envision this working out for you?
I actually see it going really good after I finish the process of getting confirmed or doing things and just promoting myself more, getting myself my name and image out there.
Well, Mia, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much and best of luck to you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Mia Davis is forward on the Temple Owls women's basketball team. And Mike Jensen, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Mary.
Mike is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Up next on the regional roundup, we'll explore the unique history of the Underground Railroad in New Jersey and some sites to visit this summer with historian Al Corbett. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's estimated that the Underground Railroad helped tens of thousands of enslaved people to freedom, and our next guest says its history in the Delaware Valley is remarkable, that there's always something new to discover. We were thinking about road trips recently and decided to ask Alvin Corbett to join us to help sketch a route through New Jersey, highlighting some of the homes, churches, and other structures used as stations or havens for fugitives on the Underground Railroad making their way north to freedom. Al Corbett has given lectures and presentations from North Carolina to New Jersey. He's one of the first museum digital archivists in the country and is a member of the Salem and Camden County Historical Societies and a friend of the Peter Underground Railroad Museum. It's good to have you with us, Al.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why were Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey in particular so essential a part of the Underground Railroad? Guessing geography played a huge role?
Geography did play a huge role, but it was the people that was located in this region that made a difference. And they also made a difference in the Underground Railroad in North Carolina, and that was a group of people called the Quakers.
So let's talk about construction of the Underground Railroad and the role played by Quaker populations. You say that as we look at sites in New Jersey, many are in locations where there were Quaker meetings, even as some Quakers had slaves. Tell us more about this.
It's an interesting topic because being from North Carolina, I knew very little about Quakers. And then when I moved to New Jersey and started looking into the Underground Railroad, I discovered when you look at the map of these black settlements, wherever there's a black settlement, there's a Quaker population in the vicinity. I don't know if your listeners know, but New Jersey was divided into East Jersey and West Jersey, and West Jersey was primarily Quaker territory, and this is pretty much the areas that the freed blacks settled.
And so is West Jersey, you know, primarily the location for Underground Railroad sites as opposed to East Jersey in the state?
It has the predominant number of sites, but there are a few sites in North Jersey, which would be also considered East Jersey. Perth Amboy had sites. You had other sites near Boomtown, New Jersey, which is north. But the majority of them are in the South.
How did Quaker religious beliefs conflict with the concept of enslaving other human beings?
What's interesting about the Quaker population is that they have an open philosophy of life, and they try to look at everybody as precious in the sight of God. However, if you look at the time frame that the Quaker religion started, slavery was an institution that they came into. And so a lot of people were practicing slavery, and they had to overcome their ideas about slavery just about like everybody else did. But they were open and willing to do it because of their philosophy.
So before we get to a discussion about, you know, actual sites that you recommend, on the Underground Railroad in New Jersey, let's talk about what enslaved people generally experienced when they reached a station. The immediate needs, Al, food, water, shelter, and rest?
That's correct. I do a lecture called The Logistics of the Underground Railroad, and what I discuss is those very things that was necessary to maintain a site. You had to have those resources to support the Underground Railroad. So when you look at any of these sites, mainly it was people who had resources, or they were working in conjunction with people who had resources. So once a person arrived at a station, for example, you had to have food, you had to have clothing, you had to have water. The time of the year which they arrived made a big difference because you had to house them somewhere. So it was a lot of things that went into the Underground Railroad. It was a sophisticated network. I've seen some historians say that it was an unsophisticated network, but it was very complex.
Yeah. We can only imagine what travelers on the Underground Railroad went through in their journey. They had to somehow trust the people, you know, the white people who were helping them. Quite a leap of faith.
Very much so. I could just imagine coming from the South to the North and dealing with whites as a slave. You don't know who to trust. Luckily, there was agents and there was a network that was established because of the Quakers and blacks such as Purvis and others who gave the reassurance that these people or these places was okay.
What were the signs that a home or church was welcoming?
That's interesting because there's been reports that there were signs. I've never seen signs on a location. But what was interesting was that you had agents in different locations who had codes. Dr. Bloxon, who's famous in Philadelphia for his research on the Underground Railroad, in his book lists the codes that was listed or the phrases that was listed. So if someone was coming, there was a load of potatoes that was coming tonight. Mm-hmm. And that was coding for those who were on the Underground Railroad working it to know that there were people coming. William Steele wrote in his book about a lot of the undertakings of the Underground Railroad, and that's how we have this information now about what was actually taking place.
Yeah, and I'd also read sometimes that passengers on the Underground Railroad might recognize a welcoming place by say, a lantern that was placed in a window.
Yes, that was a symbol, but again, there had to be someone who knew that location was okay because anyone could have had a lantern outside of the house, so there had to be other information that they went by to know that this location was okay. one of the biggest things that I've noticed about the Underground Railroad as far as getting to New Jersey was when they had to cross the Delaware, there was a special type of lantern that they used. It was blue and yellow, and that was different than any other lantern when they were crossing the Delaware, and that was one of those signs. As you mentioned, the lantern was used as an indicator. And when you look at the military now, the Navy still uses light signals for a landing on an aircraft carrier. That's an interesting tidbit to me that the logistics of things are still in play.
You told producer Paige Murray Bessler that you've been to every established Underground Railroad site in New Jersey, and you found some yourself. So let's go to the sites that you've discovered. Tell us about the experience of finding a stop on the Underground Railroad. I mean, how, Al, do you determine the existence and location of something like this?
Really, it comes down to research, and Dr. Bloxon in his book gives a lot of information. Again, the Quakers. When you read and research the Quaker locations and you understand that a lot of these free communities was established by Quakers, then you start looking into those areas and you'll find that there were areas like Timbuktu, which was land sold to freed blacks. You have in South Jersey, Springtown and Marshalltown, which again was land sold to freed blacks to establish their own communities. And so what I do is when I start doing the research, I start with the Quakers. I start with the map. There, Giles Wright was a famous PhD from Rutgers, and he and Clement Price, they did a map which showed a lot of these locations. There's about 20 locations that they found, but since then, other locations have been discovered by other researchers.
Well, describe one that you found.
One that I found was Marshalltown, and what's left there now is a small school slash church. Another location is Springtown, which is another AME Zion church. So you can find these locations, and it's interesting because it's in the middle of nowhere. A lot of the land wasn't the best land, but what you also have to realize is that they had something as opposed to having nothing. They had their own communities. And so when I do the research and I find out that there is a particular location, I want to go find it. It's almost like being Indiana Jones. You want to go find the Temple of Doom or the Lost City. You want to go find the lost cities that were inhabited by freed blacks.
Well, and when you found one of these sites, when you first visited, what have you thought or felt when you first got there?
It's interesting because what you realize is that when you hear the story of the Underground Railroad, you don't realize the particular struggle it took just to get to a location. Crossing the Delaware was not an easy task. And getting on into the state of New Jersey, which I called a gateway, you had swamps you had to overcome. If you ever drive down the Parkway or the Turnpike, you see all these waterways that you would have to cross to get there. And so you have to think about the conditions. And so you get this chilling effect that, you know, they actually traveled this route. It's not a direct route. They couldn't take the roads of that day, so they went through the wilderness. If you go to Princeton, there's a Battleground Park, and between the Quaker meeting and the house at the Battleground Park was an Underground Railroad station, mm-hmm. and you can go through the woods, and you get the sense, it's a chilling sense, because you don't know what you're going to or where you're going to, and you just have an inkling of the woods, and you hear the sounds and the crickets, and if you're traveling at night and you hear any kind of rustling, you become alerted to the fact that this was very, very spooky in some senses because of the unknowns.
Yeah, and so full of history. You just wonder if you can almost feel the spirits of the people who were there, or just the presence, you know, the people who were there centuries ago. Anyway, okay, so Al Corbett, let's work from south to north. Which sites, in your opinion, Underground Railroad sites, are can't miss for folks who might decide to get in the car and do a little road trip?
Okay, so let's pretend we're across the Delaware and we're going to land on one of the sites. There's two sites, Salem or Greenwich, New Jersey. Any one of those sites, you can find remnants of the Underground Railroad. Marshalltown is near Salem, so you can start there. You drive up the road on the Parkway, and then you hit Lawnside, which is where the Peter Mott House is located. It's still standing. Peter Mott was an agent on the Underground Railroad, and you can visit there on Saturday. It's open. And once you get from, once you've toured Peter Mott House, then you can drive up to Mount Holly, New Jersey, and visit the Underground Railroad Museum, which is where I got my start at the Smithfield Park. When you go to the Underground Railroad Museum, you'll learn a lot of the things that we've discussed today. And then once you take that tour, you can drive up to Princeton and visit the Princeton Quaker Meeting and go through that little that trail and get a sense of what it might have been like. It was interesting when I did it a few weeks ago, the cicadas was out and you could hear all the noise. And if you have never heard the cicada sing and you go through that wooded area, it's very, very
loud,
chilling. Yeah, it's loud, very loud. And so can you imagine going through this, like you said, not knowing whether or not there were slave catchers behind you or who you could trust. And you get a sense of what it must have been like going through the swamps. Very interesting feeling.
So if you go inside one of these structures, what might you find in one of these preserved areas on the Underground Railroad that indicates something, a structure that might help a fugitive, you know, a trap door, et cetera? What might we find?
So most of the houses, if you went to Salem and went to the Goodwin sisters' house, they had trap doors. If you go to Peter Mott House, you'll see the cellar. You can go inside there and see how he lived during that time as an agent. What's interesting is that you think that the neighbors had to know when you see all these people coming and going that something was going on. So you realize that the community at large was a part of it. So when you go inside, you realize how small the house was, and then you wonder, how did they hide these people? It was the attic, it was the basement, or the cellar.
And how many people might they have hidden at one time?
I think you can go anywhere between one to three people, I think, would probably be their maximum. If not, then they would probably have to, you know, it's funny, we have garages now, but then they had barns. And so they would probably have to put them in the barn or shed if there was more than one to three people, because the houses of that day was just not that big.
And there were many whites in New Jersey who were willing to help enslaved people reach freedom. But what was the state itself sympathetic at the time, Al?
New Jersey is interesting. It's just like everywhere else. Again, the attitude was that slavery is permissive. And so there were people who were on both sides. There were Quakers who owned slaves who wanted to keep slavery because they were benefiting. But then there were Quakers who were against the slavery, and so they were helping. When you go up to East Jersey, you realize that it's different because the Dutch were benefiting from the slave trade, and they weren't sympathetic. And so it's interesting because the laws, and what I've always seen is that the laws were not helpful. New Jersey was one of the last states to end slavery, even though they allowed for freed slaves to live here as free men, they still had laws on the books that was detrimental to freedom.
So you took us as far north as Princeton. We were talking about the road trip a little bit earlier. Are there any stops farther north that you might recommend to folks who are on the road?
There's not a lot of sites. The thing what happens is that when people find out that their houses or possible Underground Railroad sites, they kind of close the door on the traffic. They're not open as a museum. They're open as a private. They have a private residence, and they don't necessarily allow you to participate into the facility to see. Now, I was invited to a house in Princeton where the lady showed me that there was a hidden compartment. But that was a rare opportunity that I had in just communicating with this person. If you go up to further north, once they left Princeton, they went to Perth Amboy and through New York, you will find a lot of places. And one place in particular is John Brown's Farm. It was land given by a Quaker named Garrett, and they actually settled that land at one time and had a community there. And so usually what you see is that once you start leaving West Jersey, the locations are sparse and not necessarily known as far as the Underground Railroad sites. A lot of facilities have been torn down.
You know what, Al? We're just about out of time, but very quickly, is there a guide, if somebody wanted a little more information on this, a guide that they can access that you would recommend?
Yes, Giles Wright published a guide, and you can download it on the Underground Railroad in New Jersey, and it lists the sites that he found under his research.
Well,
that,
Al Corbett,
some of them.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I've got to jump in because we're about out of time, but it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Al Corbett is a historian who sits on the board of directors for the Underground Railroad Museum of Burlington County and much more. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us. Be well.